Two Johnnies. It's Wednesday, the 28th of September, and this is Game On. Coming up today, David Snaid and David Connolly are with us for a Nations League debrief after a roller coaster night for Irish football.
Robbie Brady back for the first time since 2020 to take this penalty kick for the Republic of Ireland. He's going to take it left footed. Robbie Brady rolls it to the net. It's 3-2, and Ireland can celebrate. Robbie Brady in his 59th international scores his ninth goal, and it's 3-2. What a topsy-turvy game this has been.
In athletics, we'll hear from Israel Alatunde and Ino Reardon on a new track for UCD and more records tumbling on the world stage.
This is road running from a different planet here in Berlin. Let's keep an eye on the clock just outside 2:01. Eliud Kipchoge is a history maker in Berlin. Yet again, he has done it. The world record has gone, and that is simply stunning.
Plus, former Dublin manager Adrian O'Sullivan is with us during a rare break for him from the intercounty camogie and hurling scene as the two codes edge closer to integration. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Hello, Adrian O'Sullivan is with me here at the top of the programme. We will be getting straight into the football very, very shortly. But Adrian, I'm just fascinated about your interest in the Irish football team. Like, you're from GAA background, I'm the same, you know, we're I suppose, look, we're reared on it, but the Irish football team always had such a special place in my heart anyway, and they're always the team that I want to do well. Would you be the same?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I suppose I was 4 years old for Italia 90 and kind of 8 years old for USA 94, so they're your formative years, aren't they? So I suppose it has a place in the hearts of all the people who were kind of kids at that time, but I would classify myself as a casual football fan, but I was in the Aviva last night, so I'd be interested to hear what the lads think. I have my own thoughts on it from having watched it, but I'm not sure if they carry as much value as what the boys will bring here now shortly.
Yeah, well, David Snaid is with us on the line. David, make sense of it for us, please do.
Make sense of it? Oh my God, how long have you got? Well, I tried to make sense of it actually in one of the articles I wrote today about it, in terms of, I just thought the 23 seconds that led to Armenia's first goal just were quite worrying from a point of view of, there were so many different mistakes both in and out of possession and decision making as well, and then just defensive attributes to it, in terms of, like, at a point where Ireland were in complete control, like total control. You're kind of, I just rewatched the game as well. Sometimes, like, when you're in the stadium, you can kind of get wrapped up and you maybe don't get a proper sense of actually the kind of threat that could have been coming at certain moments. But just rewatched it again this morning, and there was no threat from Armenia whatsoever. And it was just basically Conor Howland's decision to lump across into the box when he had three different passing options near him. And he put the ball into a cross for Troy Parra, who was the only Ireland player in the box, and he was offside. And then the goalkeeper for Armenia is able to collect the ball, and David Yurchenko, and he has 7 seconds to set up an attack, and Ireland still haven't got into any kind of defensive shape to kind of stop. And I wouldn't even call it a counter attack, because when you have 7 seconds to kind of to set it all up, it's just like a normal, like, a goal kick really, essentially, or goalkeeper throwing it out. And then from that point on, Ireland just laboured to get him back into possession, and are getting back into position, and Armenia punched them, and then they did so again a couple of moments later when Howard again played a sloppy ball across the face of goal. Luckily, Ireland, from the point of view of this campaign of our Stephen Kenny, and just for the players, that they were able to kind of compose themselves. There was enough time to compose themselves and actually get back into the game, and it finished on a high note. But it was probably one of those, because of those, that been a madness when Ireland had been in such control and had looked as if it was an ideal, not so much ideal, but because obviously you want maybe a bit more excitement, you want a couple of more goals that could have been there, but in terms of a controlled performance, it seemed to have been there. But then, because of the nature of that haphazard few minutes, it just kind of throws up a few more doubts and questions again, you know?
Yeah, it gets the conversation kind of going back to what it was a few months ago, and it feels like it's one step forward, two steps back all the time. David Connolly joins us on the line as well. Dave, we were trying to make sense of the performance last night, because I think overall it was disappointment feeling coming out of it anyway, but there was some positives, and we will get into them a little bit later. But like, we've never done it. Like, we've never went out there and played for Ireland and, you know, played in the Aviva Stadium in front of a big crowd and all the rest. So it's pretty easy for us to sit here and judge the players. But you have done that. Like, how can you explain a team that are in such cruise control, been able to switch off against opposition like Armenia when they're playing for Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, you're talking at this level. At the minute, I look at, say, when things have gone wrong, you know, for us, say, goals we've conceded, and, you know, the errors are pretty glaring, right? Which is understandable, because obviously when you concede a goal, it's easy to pick fault and go, right, this is the cause of it. But I listened to some of the things that were said after, and I know Stephen has his supporters and his detractors, but I think a lot of really good work is being spoiled at the minute David mentioned, for example, the first goal. You can pour through it and pick holes in terms of decision-making, but at the minute, that's what it comes down to, is a couple of sort of individual errors are really costing us. You know, you can go back to sort of lots of the different games, you know, avoidable goals, leads that we've had. You know, the goal yesterday, you could say, you know, Dar O'Shea, can he keep him on the outside rather than letting a left footer cut in off the right? You know, there's the goals at Gavin. I think Gavin could have done a bit better on both goals. You know, I think he could have done a bit better. I think Quiven could have done better with some of the goals that he's let in, like, say, against Ukraine at home from the free kick that went direct in, or even Armenia away from outside the box. I know it went in off the post, but, you know, when I was playing, we had an unbelievable goalkeeper in Shea Given. I look at the goals maybe we conceded at the minute, and I think Shea would have saved them. You know, Shea would have saved that. Now, I know maybe Ireland aren't blessed with a Shea Given at the minute, but I think there's a lot of good work that Stephen is doing that's just been undone ever so slightly by a combination of, I think, avoidable goals, you know, poor decision-making at times, like the square pass from Connor, the ball in the box from Connor. I think at times maybe Stephen has got his starting team wrong. I think Michael Obafemi should have been on the bench for the Scotland game and come on, but certainly should have started as he did against Armenia. I think Callum Robinson shouldn't have played away, I think, against Armenia it was. I think just a couple of things, he's not far off. So I'm not going to, like, pour through and attack him, Stephen, because I think there's a lot of really good stuff. But I also think there's a few bits that we just need to really iron out, because I don't think we're that far away from being, you know, we could have had, I think, the goals we conceded, we could have been nearly topping this group, never mind, you know, getting relegated. You go through the goals. I mean, there have been some terrible goals we've conceded. You know, the one away, I think it was against, it was Ukraine, where I think we had our back three covered over far too narrow, and they had a simple tap in at the back post. Troy Parrott had a great chance in that game. You know, we could have had far more points than we have done. So disappointing, but I think there's still a lot of good stuff. Just maybe some little individual errors have cost us.
David Snaid, by the way. The reality is, though, we barely survived relegation, and there wasn't too many performances for us to get excited about, and we are not that far away from the European campaign and still so many questions to be answered, and I don't know if we have the answers to them. The narrative is still the same, and the worry is still there as well that we're not making progress, I feel anyway.
Yeah, like, it has been a strain, and even, like, listening to David Connolly talking there, like, I do think he's right in the sense of, like, I was all recovering the game in Glasgow on Saturday as well, and it kind of, that was like a microcosm of the whole group in terms of you're coming away from it and there's regret because you feel as if it's a game that's gotten away from Ireland, and I do think in this campaign, that's probably one of the senses that you've kind of had that feeling in a few games, you know, like the first game in Armenia, the first two games, like way to Armenia and Yerevan, followed by Ukraine at home. I don't think Ireland, maybe, I think they were unfortunate to lose the first game. It was a great goal by Spertan in that game. But the second game, they were completely outplayed by Ukraine. And then they did bounce back, and obviously they got the great win against Scotland in Dublin, and that kind of, you're looking at, I think, would that kind of be a bit of a catalyst? And it kind of was, because they've done well out in and always in neutral territory in Poland because of everything that's going on in Ukraine or Russia. But then, as Dave said there as well, like, you come out early in the second half and the shape seemed to be a bit of a mess, and that was all what was the kind of the case in Scotland as well. And then Scotland are able to kick on, and at a key point Troy Parra has that chance where he's put through away Olofemi, and maybe, like, he's working so hard, you see the work he's putting in there, and the ground he's trying to cover and the runs he's making, but then just that kind of just killer instinct where he has that one chance and he doesn't take it. And it's kind of been the story pretty much for Ireland striker since Robbie Keane has hung up his boots. But like, if you look at it, I'd 100%, I definitely think there is being progress being made, because if you look at how an Ireland team are trying to play now, you can see it. You can see the players who have been brought through. A lot of the young lad players have been brought through, but they've been brought through for a reason, because they are ready. They're serious quality. I saw Gary Breen make the point over the course of the last few days, which I agree with, is it's not as if the selections that have been made, you're thinking, oh, there's more experienced players there who are very unfortunate to be dropped. Like, Stephen Kenny has been bringing some of these younger players through because they're the ones who are coming to the fore, and by and large they've kind of risen to it. Like, Nathan Collins would be a prime example of that, and even Andrew Amalamadeli before he got picked up his injury when he got in, obviously the last Euros campaign against Portugal, he was really beginning to emerge. But I definitely think there's signs of progress in terms of how the team are trying to play and the players who are coming through and what they're doing. But what needs to happen now, and I'm kind of making this point as well, is, fair enough, Stephen Kenny has identified them. He said, right, that's who he's going to hang his hat on. Now he has to show the capabilities to actually put the framework in place for those players to thrive. And I know Adrian made the joke before we came on about, oh, well, like, about our opinions being maybe more valid, but like, he and himself, I'm trying to set up a team. That's what you have to do, is have it in place where people come into a setup and know their jobs, that they're well aware of that. And at international football, when you have so little time to be able to do that, that's even more imperative.
Well, it's an interesting point, David. I suppose, like, the notes I had here before I came in, I think Stephen Kenny had to take off Malumbi last night. He'd had a bit of a wobble. He was in danger of being sent off, maybe. Hourihan came on. I suppose, was the message from Stephen Kenny to go on and make an impact, or was it to go on and fit in? And I think it comes down to game management when you're 2-0 up, is that you put somebody on and you just, you know, let's not try and reinvent the wheel here. Take a couple of simple passes and manage the game. Whereas Hourihan looked like a guy who was trying to kind of put his hand up for a jersey, and it probably wasn't the right thing. So I don't know, for David Connolly, I suppose a question to you, David, you know, in the dressing room, at what point do the players have to take responsibility? Hourihan's an international footballer, played at the highest level. Should he know how to manage this game, or are we putting the blame on Stephen Kenny for not giving him the right message?
Oh, no. I mean, look, Connor will hold his hands up. I mean, that is, for a centre mid to play a pass, you know, square across the pitch, when he can see he's got three players, at least two or three players in his eye line, he must know that's obviously going to get quiet. He made an awful error, and you might say that has got nothing to do. Stephen's got no control over that. The only control, I guess, Stephen would have is either he pulls Jason over to the sideline and says, you know, because some managers have done this, right? They've either not run the risk of being down to 10, or they've pulled the captain, or they've pulled the player and said, look, you know, you're in danger of getting sent off here. Now, I'm either going to have to take you off, or can I trust you to stay on? And then it's a question of, can that player be trusted? And what you would say is, well, you know, could he have maybe left Jason on? Because Connor's doing all right, but he's getting on. He's at Derby in League One, you know, which is no disrespect, still a great club, and etc. But I just wonder, this comes down to the fine margins of being an Ireland manager. Do you have to sacrifice him? There's been loads of games where there's lads who are on a booking, and you go, or defenders, and you go, do I take him off or not? And that is the risk you run as a manager, because that decision, you could say, impacted the game 100%. Now, you can pick holes in terms of, should the shot have been saved? Absolutely, in my opinion. But nonetheless, should Jason have come off? You know, I don't think so. I think you call him over and go, hang on, can I trust you or not? You know, and at the end of the game, you've learnt something about him rather than taking him out of the firing line. But Connor will hold his hand up and know that was a dreadful error from him. And as I said, you know, they're the fine margins for Ireland to go and get victories in international football, right? That we need is those little things that, you know, might go against us. A player coming on, not being quite at it. I think his starting team, as I mentioned, you know, I don't think St. Michael was at it, quite at it in the Scotland game, and that's because he shouldn't have started because he hasn't played enough football. You know, these are the little decisions, you know, that I think just backfired just a tiny bit on Stephen. And other than that, he hasn't got that much wrong. You know, we all know we're really good at set pieces, we're a threat. Now we've got a goal scorer who can score from outside the box. I mean, we haven't had a goal scorer for Ireland who could score from outside the box since I don't know when. You know, I obviously played with Robbie, incredible, but Robbie wasn't an outside the box merchant. You know, what we need now is an inside the box merchant like Robbie. You know, we need someone as talented in the box, because Michael can link it, as we saw with his assist for Troy against Scotland. Not only can he link it, he can score from distance. And, you know, that is something else. So, you know, there's a lot of positives, but we just might need a penalty box player. You know, we've got Scotty Hogan there. I don't know if he's worth a try. I think Troy's had his chances, but he hasn't quite taken it. I don't know how much of a natural goal scorer predator he is. As much as I like him, I just think Stephen's reliance on a performance in June was wrong for the Scotland game. I think June's a long time ago, and I think, you know, Michael, you know, did well against Armenia, but he would have done equally well with half hour off the bench against Scotland and then starting against Armenia.
You made an interesting point there, David, and it's something I'll throw over to David Snead. Is we're talking about putting pressure on Stephen Kinney here, but you just mentioned, I suppose, two key players for Ireland, one who's playing for Derby County in League One and one who's not getting a game for Swansea City. So are we expecting too much from the playing group?
But I think that's for as long as I've been covering the Ireland team for just over 10 years now, and I think it's always been a case where you almost maybe expect a bit more just because it's the Ireland team and it's maybe just almost inbred in us, and you see going back to the past but what's been achieved before and you kind of expect maybe a bit more. But I do think it's just the nature of international football where, like, and the point that David Connolly makes about maybe if he had left Jason Malumbi on and said, well, can I trust you, and if he had got sent off, he learns more about him. But then he's probably balancing that up, saying it's not even a case of he might get sent off with one more booking. It was definite he should have been already sent off for that second foul. And
we might have won 2-0 if he was sent off.
Pardon?
We might have won 2-0 if he was sent off.
Yeah, well, you never know. And this is the thing, but I personally felt the game kind of even slowed down when Conor Howard did come on. Not just, I don't think it was purely because of him, but maybe it was because maybe Ireland weren't able to get that third goal that even Armenia maybe grew in a bit more confidence and put a bit more pressure on. But I think you always want to try and, like, you expect of Ireland players, and you want to see, like, them put their best foot forward in every game, and especially over the last number of years. It's always been a case that you just felt as if that they were being maybe limited in what they were being asked to do, and, like, the amount of times you'd go to game or you'd cover games and you'd hear various managers saying about, if it wasn't, say, that there wasn't a league in this country, or it wasn't that we haven't got players who are good enough. When you have a manager and various managers talking like that, eventually it kind of wears down the kind of, like, the overall morale. I just don't see how that hasn't been the case. And I think what's needed now, and especially coming into March, would be results. That's 100% what's going to be needed for Stephen Kenny, that he's had his time now to embed players in and get his message across. And that has, I think, on the whole, I think it's been seen. Now he has to obviously balance that out by actually delivering results. But I also think, and if it wasn't Stephen Kenny, it had to be someone else, had to come in and have the kind of impact that's been needed in terms of reconnecting the fan base with a group of players. And because that had not been there, like, I covered Ireland at Euro 2016, and I don't care what anybody says, and anybody who says the sins is lying, that a lot of that leading up to that was turgid stuff. It really was. And you get there and then you have your bit of a sing song over there when you go to France, and there's some great moments and all the rest of it. But then when you come back and you start the next campaign, what's there long term to actually say, well, this is where Irish football is going. It was a case of short-term thinking, going from one to the next. Like, people are talking about Ireland not being at a World Cup, and Stephen Kenny obviously is the reason for that, because he was in charge when he didn't go through in the playoff. But like, it's 20 years since Ireland have been at a World Cup, do you know what I mean? And even the World Cup before then, it was 1994. So like, it's like, and this gets into a broader discussion, which will be for another time, but whether it was Stephen Kenny or not, a manager like him and a personality like him with the kind of ideas that he has was 100% needed. Now, as a senior manager, he's been given that bit of time, and not, I wouldn't say leeway, but given that bit of maybe a bit of a buffer to kind of try and get that across. Now, obviously, he has to deliver results, and that's what's going to be expected in the new year.
Do you think he might have done the hard work for the next man in? Like, I think we had a team last night with 7 under-23s, all of them born on the island of Ireland, which is an interesting one as well. He's kind of changed the style of football a little bit. Has he done the groundwork for the next guy to come in and be successful?
I think it's a bit disrespectful. No, I don't mean this to you, but just me even talking about today, the next man in, Stephen Kenny, is the Ireland manager. He's the one who has the contract. He'll be the one saying, well, I put this work in. And as I said, now the responsibility and the expectation would be on him to be the one to actually get onto that next stage. Like, you'll probably know this yourself, again, as someone who is trying to, when you kind of phase players through, when you bring it through kind of players you're thinking, well, they might not be quite ready now, but you know they're in that, this experience will benefit them. That's why it has to happen in March, and that's where that will be the real litmus test for him now, I would say.
David Connolly, we are getting loads of text messages in, as we always do when we mention the Ireland team or Stephen Kenny, and lots of support for Stephen, and then lots of people saying that he shouldn't be in the job. When you're in the moment like we are now, it feels everything goes into sharp focus, and it feels like there's just a huge amount of debate surrounding his job. During your day when you were playing, was it the same?
I guess it was. I mean, I think it was a little bit harder to qualify when we were playing, and obviously we lost out, albeit with a very, very good team, in so many playoffs, I lost count. But, you know, if I think about the let's just look at the Nations League, right? Because, you know, this is what we're looking at. We had leads, you know, Ukraine away, Scotland, we had the lead. Obviously, we had the lead against Armenia, which we nearly blew. But we've had leads in games. We've conceded bad goals from outside the box, avoidable goals. You know, as I said earlier, like, I think the Armenia away, I think Quiven should have done a bit. I think he should have done a little bit better. Ukraine at home, I think that was an avoidable goal. We can keep going on. I think there's far more positives than there are negatives. I think the issue for Stephen will be, as it will constantly be, if he's going to play this back three, I think he's got a little bit of an issue in terms of who's going to be his left wing back. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go back to, say, the Ukraine game away, where, you know, I think James McClain was a little bit high. He may be, you know, how are we going to play with that wing back? Is he, when we don't have the ball, is he going to turn into a fullback because we're a bit slow to quickly turn around and get goal side and be a fullback? Robbie, brilliant on the ball, you know, but do we need someone a bit, I don't know, more dynamic as that left wing back who's really good defensively? Because when we've looked vulnerable, it's been in those wide areas, people getting in behind our outside centre backs or getting down the sides. And that might be one area he looks at. Then he's got to balance out, well, who's playing? You know, who's playing where? We don't really know yet how our front players are going to get on. I imagine Nathan Collins is going to keep playing. I think Gavin will keep playing in goal, which is good. But he's heavily reliant, I think, on which players are playing and in form, rather than now hanging his hat on, say, this performance in a few months' time and going, right, I'm going to... You know, Michael, for example, Obafemi did well in that game. He's going to start again for me in 3 months' time. I think it's dangerous because it's almost like he set his stall out a little bit looking at those games in June and looking at those performances. And I think he got a similar performance, but I think it took him 90 minutes to get that sort of second performance. Whereas in some games, you're not going to be able to, like in Nations League, you're not going to be able to do that. You're not going to be able to have a sort of... an okay performance in the first game, but you're ready and you're sharp for the second game. He wants lads who are 100% at it, and I think a couple of his team selections have been wrong. And I think, you know, I think we've sort of paid the price a little bit for that, although I think he's got it right in the end.
David Snaid, we probably need an extended show for this, but, you know, we're talking about players and where we're lacking and where we need to be better, and, you know, like, the striker options are improving, but the midfield, we still seem to need that creativity. But when we look at what we have, we are getting the best out of the group there, and they do work really hard. But are we developing players enough? Like, is there, can you, as somebody who's studying the underage teams coming through, can you say, well, in 3, 5, 7 years we're going to have a crop of players coming through that is going to be able to fill the roles that we need them to? Or are we still kind of focused and fixated on the fact there's a lost generation there?
I think it's one of them where I don't think quite at that stage where it's like a lost generation coming, or we're in the midst of, because I do think there's definitely, you can see by the youngsters as who've come through, and say youngsters, but they're like men playing football, and a lot of them are playing regular football for their clubs, be it in the Premier League or the Championship. But then you look at, say, below, and I think it is at the point where, and again, this comes back to how kind of I mentioned earlier about kind of the whole short-term thinking and the long, well, what's the long-term strategic view of developing players. And obviously, over the last number of years, anybody who's been paying attention to the League of Ireland knows that that's what the big shift has been from the traditional, maybe, schoolboy clubs, and the integration of the, obviously, the underage leagues between now from age under 14 up to under 19. And you would hope now, obviously it's going to take a bit of time, but you would hope that you're going to get those little kind of, like Gavin Bazunu is a prime example, obviously coming through at Shamrock Rovers, gets his move to Man City, goes, has a couple of loan spells in the lower leagues in England, and then is now number one at Southampton. But like, obviously we see yesterday with the 21s as well, they went out, like the likes of, say, a Will Smallbone, a Connor Coventry, talking about midfield players. You would like to say, well, would they possibly, over the next little while, because I don't think it's going to happen straight away, will they get introduced when the time is right? I think Will Smallbone, you talk about creativity, he could be that type of player. He has, like, David Connolly will know him from Southampton. Like, he kind of had a bit of a rough time that he's gone to Stoke on loan to kind of get game time, and seems to be thriving there. But then you even look as well over the last week, and obviously natural with the how it's gone with the senior team, with the 21s as well, possibly gone under the radar a little bit with the under 19s, and some of the three qualifying results they had, finishing top of their group with Hungary and Wales, and Gibraltar scoring 9 goals, not conceding. And there's a sprinkling of players there, like Kevin Zesty, who was at Inter Milan, James, and obviously would have came through at Shamrock Rovers, James Bankwell would have came through at Pasties, gone to Udinese. There's Justin Ferrishoy, who's played in Europe in the Conference League and the qualifiers for Rovers, and has been linked with moves to Italy. Sam Curtis, who's at St. Patrick's Athletic, who again Feyenoord have been in for him, actually, who David will know well. But listen, we can talk about that. We can talk about those young kids now, but that's what they are. They're still kids. We don't know. There's such a leap to break through. Like, it does look as if it's promising that there will be a crop there, but you can never know. You really can't. It's all like, there will always be later developers as well who kind of develop when they get a chance at senior football at club level. So there's still promising signs there, like what David says, even with the senior team.
David?
I mean, just quickly, if I come in on that as well, David, I mean, I can just tell you from my experience, I've got a young. He's 12 years old, a boy in an academy in England, right? And his club sent round a Welsh FA document for any players who've got Welsh ancestry, right? So Wales FA are looking at boys who are 12 years old.
Wow.
Welsh roots. And I thought, I've had nothing for Ireland. I hadn't seen anything for Ireland. Now, I had a look on the FAI site, the under-15s, you know, I think they've got one boy from Blackburn. The 18s have got no one from any English clubs. But it just struck me that, well, you know, fair play to Wales, because they're trying to pick up kids, get them in the system, track them when they're 12, 13, 14 years of age. Now, whether that's right or wrong, and whether they would ever call them into any sort of training camp at that, at 12 or 13 or 14, I don't know. But let me tell you, they're looking, and it makes me think, well, should Ireland be looking? You know, when am I going to look at my phone on and I get a notification, this is the FAI for Ireland, you know, does your son have any Irish roots? Because at the minute, it's just Wales FA. And I think, I just found that really interesting, you know. Predominantly Irish-based players when they're in the 15s, 16s, 18s, as I said. But it'll be interesting if they cast that net a bit wider, a bit earlier, maybe like the Welsh are doing.
Wasn't that the problem that was thrown at the under-21s a few years ago, was that the manager spent all his time going around England looking for guys who were a quarter Irish when the talent at home has been completely neglected? So you could argue that the Welsh FA, by looking at 12-year-olds in England, they're neglecting what's right in front of their face. Should they not be focusing on what they have in Wales instead of looking outside the country, you know?
Yeah, no, look, I think there's enough resources. You can cover all bases, you know, and you cast that net far and wide as much as you can. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because, you know, look, you might lose a couple, you never know, as they progress, but, you know, you also might keep quite a few. And if you look at, you know, some of the youngsters that Wales have got through down the years, whether it's Ethan Ampadu or, you know, Dan James, you can keep going. You know, I think the FAI should be able to work with both, run both.
Now, David, tell us, what position is your son so we can start looking forward?
Oh, he's a midfielder.
Yes.
He's a midfielder, so yeah.
That's what we like to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well,
yeah.
We'll be tracking him for sure. David, thanks a million. Both Davids, thanks a million. That wasn't complicated at all. Thanks so much for coming on. So look, we've went through it anyway. We'll probably be having the same conversations again in a few months. We look forward to the draw for the Euro campaign anyway, and we will take it from there. We're going to take a very quick break now, though, but stay with us. We'll be back with plenty more to come.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to the show with me, Marie Crowe. Adrian O'Sullivan, former Dublin Camogie manager, is in studio with me as well. We are going to turn our attention now to athletics, and I'm delighted to say that it is a good news story. A little bit earlier on, the new 8-lane athletics track in UCD was officially opened, and Ian O'Riordan was there, and he joins us now on the line. Ian, a good day for athletics.
Great day, Marie. Yes, I was just across the road actually in Belfield a few hours ago to see the official opening of this new track, and it's kind of been a story dear to my heart, but a story dear to anybody who ran on the old Belfield track, kind of the other side of campus, but obviously across the road there from RTE, which has been there for the best part of 20, 30 years, and unfortunately got dug up in November of 2011, and so that's over a decade ago now, where Belfield was without any running track whatsoever. So it took a big donation, an anonymous donation of €3 million to actually get this project off the ground. That was about 5 years ago. Then, of course, you throw COVID into the middle of all of that and a few other delays. So it's about 2 years behind schedule, but now very much up and running. And just being over there this afternoon, and you see some of the UCD athletes. I mean, we've seen the likes of Israel Olatunde make a big breakthrough this year in 100 metres. And you've obviously got Sarah Healy, Luke McCann, and Keane McPhillips, a young distance runner, and Darren McElhinney. But what struck me about it was just it's become a kind of a social sort of focal point of the UCD campus, and I think that's something that was missing as well, that the old Belfield track, it had that kind of community place where people would just come to meet and go for a run or do a session or hang out after a session. And that's the one thing that struck me about this new track, that it's not just a training track, but it's somewhere to go and meet and hang out and talk about running and share ideas, and that's clearly a positive thing.
What's it look like up there?
It looks beautiful, but it's blue. It's blue to probably match the colours of UCD, but it's certainly not the first blue running track in the world. I mean, the Berlin stadium track is blue, and by pure coincidence, about 4 miles up the road in Dundrum, South Dublin, they've just finished their new running track after almost as long as a wait, and that's also blue. So it's a bit like the old bus story. You wait 10 years for one to come along, and then two come along at the same time.
The one in UL is blue as well, Ian. It must be the same lads putting them down everywhere.
Oh, have we still got Ian? No, we've lost Liam, but we're going to get him back in a second.
Yeah, we lost him because that sounded like a lead balloon otherwise.
Well, Ian mentioned Israel Olatunde there, and he hit the headlines recently when he broke the record for the 100 metres. So I guess that makes him Ireland's fastest man. Well, he was at the UCD track today, and he spoke to Claire McNamara. Let's hear from him.
Oh, it's an amazing facility. It's really great to be here and just see all the planning come to fruition. And it's going to be a great addition to the club, the college, and the community. So I'm really excited to get training.
What would it mean to your everyday schedule and training?
Yeah, it means the world. We don't have to travel like around Dublin to get to tracks. We have one right here on our doorstep. So in between classes, you can get out here, get our training done. And yeah, it's just really great to have.
Before now, when you finished your studies or your classes, you had to get on the bus or get on whatever and go to Tala or Ringsend, was it?
Yeah, so I train in Tala, so a bit all over the place, Tala, Blanchardstown, everywhere really. So it's really great to have it right here, somewhere that we can call our own really, for UCD Athletics and for the community in general.
And a great crop of young athletes coming through here now, isn't there? There's yourself, there's Sarah Healy, many others.
Yeah, it's really like inspiring to just be a part of like the young athletes coming through here in UCD. Hopefully we can inspire like the next generation, but we're just going to keep going and see what we can do.
Now you really grabbed the headlines over the summer, Ireland's fastest man. How have you been coping with all that?
It's been great, just seeing like reaction of everyone, and it's just giving me so much motivation for the next season ahead. So I'm looking forward to getting back to work and just seeing what we can do in 2023.
What are your short-term goals then first?
Just to get faster really, my next big championship is the European Indoor Championship in Istanbul in March, so just gearing up for that, just see what we can do.
And then more longer-term, Paris?
Yeah, 100%, that's every athlete's dream to make the Olympics, and with Paris coming up, I'm just going to give my all and see where we can get.
That was Israel Olatunde speaking to Claire McNamara a little bit later on at the opening of the UCD Athletics track. Ian O'Riordan is back with us now again, and he actually makes a great point there, Ian. When you're a kid or someone even just training or wanted to be an athlete, if you're going up to the track and you're seeing the likes of Israel up there, I mean, talk about inspiration in the flesh.
Yeah, it's true. And again, I mean, I'm getting too nostalgic about it. I remember the old Belfield track, and I used to go down there as a young fella with my dad, and we'd see the likes of Eamon Coughlin, John Tracy training on that track. And there was the famous world 4x mile record that was set there in 1985, a record that still stands, by the way. And I remember being massively influenced by that and just seeing the possibilities of running just because it was happening live in front of us. And again, that's just been absent in South County Dublin. And I'm not being biased towards this part of the world, but I mean, it's one of the most populated areas of Dublin. UCD has got the highest student body of any university in Ireland. So to not have a running track there was just like a gaping wound, I suppose you could say, in Irish athletics. So it's wonderful to see that open. And it's not just for UCD. This is for use for schools, for clubs, obviously. They're going to have competitions there next year. Maybe get Athletics Ireland might use it as a training base if they want to use it as a, set up a training camp instead of having to go into warm weather training, provided we get the weather, of course. So there's a huge benefit to Irish athletics, and it's the classic case of inspiring a next generation. And we've seen it already in UCD, and go back 20-30 years, and even with the track in UCD, you're always looking towards America. If you're a young athlete saying, I need to go to America to get the facilities to train in the right environment. But I mean, being over there this afternoon looking at UCD, and it's part of that what they're calling the sports end of campus now, so you're kind of in the same area as the rugby team, Leinster rugby train around there. You have the indoor swimming pool, so it's a very much sporting end of campus, and that's exactly what UCD Athletics needed.
Yeah, it's synonymous with the college there, so it's amazing to have it back, and no doubt there'll be more great memories created like the ones that you outlined there as well. And just before we finish up, Ian, a bit of news on the London Marathon. Mo Farah is out with an injury.
Yeah, well, I'm not entirely surprised by that. I know he was talking up a big race, but I think Mo Farah's years may well best be behind him. Although having said that, he's the same age as 37. He's the same age as Eliud Kipchoge, the Kenyan marathon runner who we saw break the world record last Sunday in Berlin when he ran his 2:01:09, which knocked 30 seconds off his previous best, and looked like for a while he was going to break 2 hours. He passed halfway in under an hour, which is the fastest official halfway split in marathon history. And he finished in a world record of 2:01:09. So maybe Mo's not quite finished yet, but I'm not quite sure if he has the longevity that Kipchoge is showing.
Will Kipchoge get under the two?
Pardon me?
Will he get under the two?
I think Sunday might well have been his last chance. I think he's not getting any younger, and conditions were perfect, and he clearly went for it. He clearly knew that. He went out fast, with the idea being that if he could hang on, as opposed to maybe finishing in a negative split, he slowed quite dramatically over the second half of the race. I mean, there's no doubt that he was. I think the last 3,000 meters was probably his slowest of the race. But I mean, he was still averaging around 14:20, 14:25 for 5,000 meters. And anybody's run a park run on a Sunday, thinking, okay, if I ran a 5,000 meter, say in 14:20 or 14:25, I'd be fairly well flying. Well, imagine putting putting eight of those back to back, and then doing another 2 kilometres at the finish to run as 2:01. I actually can't fathom what he ran, to be perfectly honest about it. But would he break 2 hours? I think at this stage of his career, it's unlikely. So maybe that's the one last barrier in sport which may not be broken in our lives.
Interesting. Well, I think I'm going to speak for most of the population when I say no, I cannot imagine running anything like that at all, ever. Ian, thank you so much. And again, a great day for athletics in Ireland to see that track back in UCD. I might even take a trip up there myself to check it out. Talk to you soon, Ian.
Indeed. Thanks again.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is 18:47. Adrian O'Sullivan is with me in studio. I'm Marie Crowe, and we are now going to talk camogie. Well, we're going to talk a lot of things. We're going to start with camogie, Adrian. I'm going to put you on the spot. When I saw the news that you were stepping away from the Dublin camogie job, I was like, okay, fair enough. I was surprised. I thought, okay, maybe he needs a bit of a break. You've done so well. There's loads of potential there. It seemed like you were on the right pathway for you and for the girls and everything. And that was all grand. But then you went in with the Dublin young lads, the minors. And I was really surprised, because I would have just, look, I'll be straight up about it. In my mind, from just a purely managerial career point of view, leaving the Dublin camogie senior women's team to go to the minor Dublin hurling team seems like a step back in career.
I finally figured out who Gin 5040 on Reservoir Dubs is, so that's who that day asked the same thing. I get my head around that question. I'm still trying to process Kipchoge's split times.
Deflection here now. You were firmly on the spot.
That old Jimmy Carr joke, isn't it? It took him 11 seconds to watch Usain Bolt do the 100 metres in 9 seconds. But I suppose from the outside, it might seem like an unusual one. Look, you know it firsthand, having an absentee county manager in your house, that the demands of it are just gone absolutely crazy. It is a full-time job. I know it sounds like such a cliche, but it really is. So that was one of the reasons. I've been so lucky with work, that during COVID we were able to work from home, and I suppose the schedules are a little bit flexible, and you could kind of, I suppose, mould your all the rest of your life around inter-county involvement. I suppose we were coming out of COVID now, and work was getting really busy, and it was just a conversation I had with my boss at work that, they'd been so understanding for the last couple of years that kind of felt that really I kind of had to actually concentrate on doing my day job and give a little bit more of my energy back to them as well. So that was a part of it. I suppose the other part of it kind of comes down to a couple of things. I kind of decide myself whether I want to be a manager or a coach, which maybe some people listening maybe don't realise the difference between the two, and they're very, very different roles in the modern game. Definitely at county level, maybe not so much at club level. And then just trying to, I suppose, find my way as a coach and settle on a coaching style, and I suppose kind of try and figure out what principles that I want to bring into my coaching and I want to see have reflected in my teams. The teams that I would really, I suppose, look up to would be Limerick and Kilkenny from a hurling point of view. And I suppose it's an aggressive, confrontational style mixed with flair. And I suppose we tried to bring that into camogie this year, and we were probably known as being one of the more physical teams, but then the refereeing is so frustrating. Some days you go out and it's fine and you can put your mark on a game, and then other days you're giving away 40 frees, and I just found myself getting very frustrated with that. And I was kind of left with a crossroads as to whether, okay, do I adjust my whole coaching ethos specifically for camogie, or do I kind of stick to my principles and stick to where I want to develop as a coach and just go down the hurling route. I suppose that's really what it came down to. A few hurling offers came in, that's where it came from. So there wasn't any one thing. Thoroughly enjoyed my time with the guys. Savage team. I hope we've left behind a really good setup for the next guys in to take over and drive it on.
So I'm going to just pick one point out of that. If the rules were, or maybe the interpretation of the rules were a little bit different in camogie, do you think that you'd have had a longer stint there as the double manager?
Yeah, I think so. I think it definitely played a huge part in it. It's so frustrating. I suppose I can't get myself in trouble anymore. I can't get a future suspension from camogie. But I think the quality of the officiating isn't up to standard either as to what you'd expect or what you get in hurling either, even at club level, So I'm not even sure if it's interpretation of the rules. Well, yeah, it is interpretation, because some of the referees, I suppose, took the new contact law and really went with it. And you have savage open games and huge physicality, and that's what the players want as well. That's what everybody wants. Then you go out another day and you play the exact same way, and it just turns into a free taking contest, and it's just so hard to predict what's going to happen. I think The change in the rules was definitely a step forward, but they really just have to embrace the physical side of the game. Like, we've players bench pressing 70 kilos, doing, you know, 10 reps of wide arm chin ups and side in the gym and deadlifting all sorts. And like, every county is the same, and that's just the way the game has gone. I think just the rules just haven't quite kept up with the change and the development of the players, both physically and from a skill point of view, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that's a conversation we've had about both codes as well, and you would hope that the governing bodies are looking at that and trying to I guess bring it more in line with the developments in sports science and the physical developments of the players as well. I feel sometimes we're a little bit critical of the referees, a little bit too critical. It is a tough job, and nobody's perfect, and there's not many people putting their hands up. We'd like at times for them to do a better job, but it's not always the case. They're all human as well, and sometimes it can be a difficult situation for them. So I'm kind of loath to too critical of
especially
of
in
them
the current
either.
Environment as well. Like, I suppose it's not so much being critical of the referees. It's more so, can we get a bit of consistency across all the referees? Like, referees are going to make mistakes. Coaches make mistakes. Players make mistakes. That's part of the game. It's a dynamic game. It's hard to get it right all the time, but. Like, you know, if you get a couple of decisions wrong during a game, that's fine, but you have to have your overall philosophy towards the game has to be the same with all the referees, otherwise it's impossible to judge when you're going out in the field what you're going to get, you know.
And just a general point on referees, like as I said at the start of the show, you know, we both come from GAA backgrounds. It's what we've grown up in. We know it inside out, and we've both seen firsthand incidents in games where referees have been subjected to abuse. It's now gone to other levels of late where it's turning into physical abuse, and unfortunately, Adrian, even the consequences, the punishments, the online shaming, the public interest, the coverage in the media, nothing seems to be deterring people from stopping confronting and assaulting and interfering and abusing referees. It is ongoing all the time, and it's particularly prevalent now this season, it feels like it anyway. And even just now 30 minutes ago, there's a report on WLRFM that an under 12 hurling match in Waterford had to be abandoned on Monday night over an alleged incident involving a match official. So it's not getting any better.
No, it's not. I mean, my dad was a referee, and I would have covered a few games for him years ago just when he was stuck and stuff like that. Was never qualified or anything, but he used to always send me out doing the adult games because he said the worst games to referee were the underage games. Just the behaviour on the sideline was just incredible, you know. But look, I think David Fitzgerald came out there the other day and said, look, that the sanctions for what's happening aren't strong enough. You know, I think anyone who walks onto a field and puts their hand on a volunteer official just should have no place in the game whatsoever, and like the clubs should face much bigger sanctions as well. I give out about referees, everybody does, but without them we have no games. And look, they're volunteers at the end of the day trying to do their best, and they should never feel that they're in personal danger walking out onto a GAA field.
Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting time ahead as they try and figure out the best way to approach sorting out this issue, which has turned out to be a really big one and a blight on our games for sure. Adrian, integration. So it feels like we're after taking a little bit of a step closer. Mary McAleese is going to be involved now in trying to bring the associations together. Do you feel like we're going to get there?
Well, there was an article about Mary McAleese the other day where she got stuck in an argument between Tibet and China, so she's well versed in getting the camogie and the ladies football to the same table, isn't it? I do think there's a step forward. I think the first big step forward towards integration was when the GPA, the male side of the GPA, voted for integration with the WGPA, which was set up back in the day by Aoife Lane and Fiona McHale and all that crew. I think that was a massive step forward from the players' point of view, and that has kind of paved the way for what's about to come. Is it going to be straightforward? I don't know. I think maybe looking at it, the LGFA probably have their house in fairly good order. Maybe do they have the most to lose? Do they have all the television deals, sponsorships, all their games played in county grounds, stuff like that? Maybe the Camogie have the most to gain. Maybe they've been left behind a little bit with the television coverage and with the high level sponsors and stuff like that. Is it going to be a silver bullet? I don't know. I've been involved in county coaching with the likes of Kildare and Westmead, where the teams would be perceived as the second team in the county, and that's not all roses either, you know. So like, if you look at the way, I suppose, the GAA treated the lower level hurling competitions, and when Sean Kelly, I suppose, invented the Christie Ring back in the day, and then they brought in the Joe McDonagh afterwards, they were supposed to be centrepiece occasions as part of the GAA, and next thing they were just shoveled off into a Saturday afternoon in front of an empty Croke Park, and there's no coverage, there's no media coverage, there's no anything. So, like, if we take a step back for a second, is this going to be a silver bullet where everything's going to be all rosy after it? I don't know. So Mary certainly has an interesting job in her hands, but it's definitely a positive move. I think for players, like, I suppose the note that I wrote down here, like, we had a player from Castleknock, Aisling O'Neill, and Fogg's going to be playing Castleknock in a couple of weeks, Kieran Kilkenny will be playing, but when they leave for Dublin training in the morning and they come down through tolls and they're burning their own diesel and everything, Kieran will get a few quid in his pocket for it and he'll go home and Aisling doesn't. So why is that? And before people start texting in different associations, yeah, I'm fully aware of that argument, that's fine.
But people love texting that in, by the way.
They absolutely love that. But at a base level, why is Kieran Kilkenny getting reimbursed for it and Aisling O'Neill isn't? That's the question. I think integration hopefully will be a step forward towards that. But look, it can only be a positive thing, I suppose, yeah.
I agree. It can only be a positive thing, and hopefully we will get there in the end. Adrian O'Sullivan, thank you so much for coming in. That is all we have time for. Tonight we are handing over to Tara Kumar for the very last time. A sad day here in 2FM to be saying goodbye to Tara. And for most people listening to Game On, are probably big sports fans and might not understand just how cool Tara Kumar is. Well, she is the Joe Canning of radio broadcasting. She's the person that walks around. Everybody wants to be near her, to talk to her. She lights up the room, and you know, even my little boys, when they come in, they want to meet Tara Kumar. They don't care about Ruby Walsh or Donegal O'Callaghan. Tara Kumar is the queen. And Jenny Green as well, she's outside here looking at me. So Tara Kumar, for the very last time, that is all we have time for, and Tara is next. RTE 2FM.